This is Money Talking from WNYC. I'm Charlie Herman. At the start of the new year, you probably made a bunch of resolutions for both your personal and work life. Maybe the two even dovetail. Get better organized. Focus on the things that matter. Don't let email control your life. Okay, well, maybe those are just my resolutions. But you get the point. New year, new resolutions. But now, several weeks into the new year, how you doing with those goals? Drop some? Maybe all of them? Well, if you did, don't beat yourself up, because there's still time to recommit to your goals. At least that's according to Tomas Chamorro. He's a professor of business psychology at University College London and a frequent contributor to the Harvard Business Review. And I began our conversation by asking him, why don't we seem to be able to accomplish the goals we set out for ourselves at the start of the year?
I think mostly because they are goals that relate to changing habits that have formed for a long time period. And these are things that aren't just, you know, small, tiny habits, but the things that maybe have been subconsciously rewarded for a number of years. So, I mean, and if you really look at most of the things people try to change, health-related habits, things relating to their careers, relationships, I mean, these are habits that have accumulated for so long that they really form part of people's broad personality.
So they're much broader. They're almost too big to try and change.
It's a little bit like trying to change your very nature. And although that's possible, it does require a lot of work and many years.
So what do you do then if you set some of these goals, especially in the workplace dealing with coworkers, and it's already failed? What can you do to restart or get yourself back on track on those resolutions?
The important thing is to understand that you might not have failed, because on the whole, if out of 3 or 4 weeks since I started, I have improved my typical behavior, it doesn't matter if at some point I made a mistake, because I have to keep on doing it. So if my resolution is to be nice to my colleagues and I have an argument, but on the whole, I've had less arguments in these past 3 or 4 weeks, then I'm still doing better. It's no point abandoning it. A little bit like when you're dieting or trying to control your food habits. Well, maybe you have the occasional burger or you binge up, but it doesn't mean that you have to abandon it completely, because this is a 6 or 12 months process in most cases.
Well, when it comes to making changes in our lives, is part of the problem that we focus so much on things like, I'm going to eat better, I'm not going to drink as much, I'm not going to get mad at my coworkers, and we don't necessarily come up with resolutions that actually build on some of the strengths that we already have?
The strengths-focused movement or approach makes some sense, because it is a lot easier to leverage your typical tendencies already and become better at what you're already good at. So, I mean, I like that about the strengths movement. At the same time, I think there is a clear disadvantage or a logical flaw in that movement, which is that it often is used as an excuse for people to just completely neglect what they're not doing right, you know, what they're doing wrong. And if you only focus on your strengths, you know, you would probably suffer from some derailers or toxic tendencies.
You're avoiding dealing with the more negative traits of your personality.
Exactly, absolutely. So in the world of sports, for example, professional athletes do get better by working on the strengths, but at the same time, they do try to minimize their weaknesses.
Tomas, thank you.
Thank you.
Tomas Chamorro is a professor of business psychology at University College London and the author of Confidence, The Surprising Truth About How Much You Need It and How to Get It. One resolution you might have is doing a better job managing your money, how you spend it, how you save it. If you do have this problem, well, part of that might come from how you talked about money when you were growing up, if you talked about it at all. Well, Ron Lieber thinks it's time for parents and kids to start having honest conversations about money. He's the Your Money columnist for the New York Times and author of the new book, The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. Hi, Ron.
Hello.
So even in families, why is talking about money so emotionally fraught?
There's all sorts of reasons that this epidemic of silence exists among, you know, many, if not most families that have more than they need. You know, some of it is fear, fear that the parents will be found out by the kids who are under 18 as people who actually aren't that responsible, who aren't great role models. There may be shame about what they're spending their money on, or shame that they haven't saved enough and they're worried that their kids will ask a lot of questions. And then there's also a fear of all sorts, fear of embarrassment if the kids talk about it. They don't want to raise money-grubbing children, which is actually an irrational fear. So it really kind of runs the gamut.
So then how do you start the conversation with kids when it comes to money?
Well, the kids are actually probably going to start the conversation with you, whether you want to or not, because kids are naturally curious. It is their job to figure out how the world works, and money is a source of great mystery, so they are going to ask you about it. So you have to be ready.
Well, you know, perhaps the biggest financial decision that kids are going to make is one that will really affect their entire lives, and that's choosing if they should go to college, what type of college to go to, how much they should spend. I mean, that can affect their future income, but also can affect if they have debt that they're carrying for a large period of time. And yet we kind of leave it to them often to decide.
So you've seized on the crucial endpoint of this process that is different from the way it was 20, 30, even 10 years ago. Children, mere teenagers, 16 and 17-year-olds, are now facing six-figure decisions in their teens when it comes to thinking about where they're going to college and what they're going to pay. And they're contemplating, again, at 16 or 17, whether they want to take on well into the five figures of student loan debt, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 that they're signing up for. If we have not been talking to them about trade-offs and value and saving and good financial decision-making for a decade before that, how on earth can we possibly expect them to make a good decision as teenagers? It's crazy.
You know, your book is How to Talk to Kids About Money, but are there lessons here for adults?
Sure. So you need to ask yourself the question, right? What is it that's important to you? How much is enough? And you need to be honest with yourself about those things. And many people have trouble doing them on their own. They may have trouble, you know, doing it with one another. Money is all wrapped up in all sorts of feelings and emotions we have about, you know, who we are and whether we're successful. This isn't easy. And I don't mean to imply that, you know, every parent walks into this with their head screwed on straight. But often the process of having to teach it to kids, having to, because we really do have to, helps the parents or the parent figure it out for themselves in a more kind of speedy way.
Ron, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Ron Lieber is the author of The Opposite of Spoiled, Raising Kids Who Are Grounded, Generous, and Smart About Money. He's also the Your Money columnist for the New York Times. And I'm Charlie Herman, and this is Money Talking from WNYC.